Writings on the Wall by Katie Falls, read by CookieMom6067. One of Andy's earliest memories is of waking up in the middle of the night. She can't remember what woke her, some sound perhaps, or just a dream, and creeping out of bed to find her mother in the tiny living room of their dingy flat, shrugging into her black raincoat. It must have been close to midnight. "Go back to bed, darling," her mother said, voice low and soothing. "Mummy will be back before you wake." "What are you doing?" Andy asked. She couldn't have been more than 5 years old. Her mother smiled grimly. Andy's been told she has her mother's smile. "Making the world safer for you, my love." She tucked a pistol into her handbag, gave Andy a kiss on the forehead, and slipped out the door. Andy remembers going back to bed, as instructed, because Andy's mother was the sort of woman you obeyed without question. She must have fallen asleep. In the morning, her mother was scrambling eggs for breakfast as though nothing had happened. That time, at least, she did come back. "Orphans make the best recruits," Em told her once, her voice laced with regret. Andy isn't one for armchair psychology. That sort of bullshit itches under her skin, but those words resonate with her even now. It's not the whole story, but Em isn't wrong. Andy will always hate the woman at least a little bit for how often she's right. She knows something's amiss when it's Lycan on the comm for the last leg of her Odessa mission. It's not that Lycan isn't an excellent tech. He certainly understands operations from a 00's perspective, having been one himself, but well. Q generally calls dibs on Andy's missions these days is the thing. Andy doesn't comment until she's completed the file transfer from the Mark's laptop and successfully extricated herself from his gaudy DACA. As missions go, this one was important but unexciting, which she does appreciate on occasion. There is such a thing as too much excitement, especially in her line of work. "All right, Lycan," she murmurs, once she's safely stowed away in a freight train en route to the Moldovan border. "You gonna tell me what's gone wrong?" There's silence in her earpiece for a long moment. "It's need to know, Andromache." "Fuck, that means it's really bad." "No blackout orders, so I assume no one's defected this time. Agent down?" Lycan sighs. "Andy. Who'd we lose?" "We haven't," he says. "Not yet, anyway. But..." "It's Nikki DeGeneva. Joe called it in about 20 minutes before you checked in at the DACA." Andy kicks out at the side of the train car, all futile rage. "God damn it! Wait, isn't Joe still out on medical leave? What the hell was he doing out on mission?" She keeps pretty close tabs on her fellow agents, particularly the newer ones. "Look, I'm sure Q will fill you in as soon as you're back. You know as much as I do at this point." She tilts her head back until it thunks against the metal. "All right, fine. Signing off for now." "No, wait, Lycan." "I'll let you know," he says gently, leaving unsaid, "if Nikki dies. It's going to be a long trip back to London." During Andy's first mission as a 00, she stabbed a man through the eye with a letter opener. That wasn't what killed him, of course. She finished him off by breaking his neck, but she'd surprised herself with the sheer savagery of it. It bothered her later just how unbothered she was. Since then, she's encountered more than her fair share of true sadists and can definitively say she is not one of them. But violence sits a little too comfortably in her body, feels as natural as fucking, as riding a horse. Hers is an easy physicality. Maybe it shouldn't be. This is why she needs to believe her cause is just. Always find ways to push back against M, demands answers for hard questions, refuses to accept any mission without first understanding the why behind it, because otherwise she could be monstrous. Perhaps she is anyway. She's not always sure it's a bad thing that 00's rarely survive to retirement, But even so, it cuts deeply every time she loses another of her cohort, each scar crisscrossing over the last, until she wonders how no one else can see them on her chest. Or maybe it's just the same old wound, reopening anew each time, bleeding fresh. Quinn is there the instant Andy sets foot in MI6 headquarters, nearly 12 hours later. 009 pulled through, she says at once. So there's no need to play the avenging angel just yet, dear. How did it happen? Andy demands. Lycan didn't have any details. Quinn grimaces. Shit luck. It's a long story. Herself plans to debrief you personally. What fun that will be. Can you at least... Was he shot or in some kind of accident or... Shot, Quinn confirms. By accident, sort of. It was 002 who took the shot, but he was aiming for the man 009 was fighting, and there was a train involved, so, like I said, long story. May I have a kiss before you storm the castle? Andy rolls her eyes, but only to cover the smile as she leans in. Quinn can likely feel it against her lips anyway. When they break apart, though, her mind is already pressing forward. Why was Joe shooting at Nikki? I thought they almost got along these days. Because I ordered it, someone says crisply behind her. Andy smooths any trace of expression from her face as she turns to see M. 007, welcome back. As you have apparently been made aware, we have much to discuss. Andy keeps her tone neutral. There's a reason why medical leave is mandated after sustaining trauma on the job. May I ask why Al Kazani was in the field at all? You may, M says coolly. In my office. Thank you for catching 007 up to speed, Q, but if you will excuse us? Yes, ma'am, Quinn says, and waits until M's back is turned before pulling a face for Andy's benefit. Andy bites back a smirk as she follows her boss upstairs. The chief of staff's office is directly adjacent to M's, sharing an antechamber. Copley pokes his head out for a second when he hears them arrive, but just gives Andy a nod before returning to his own desk, murmuring quietly into his headset. She glimpses activity tracking across several different monitors. Once Andy shuts the door behind them, she turns to M, expectantly. M presses her lips together, eyes cast heavenward for a moment, as if seeking patience. Andy is very accustomed to that particular expression when she's involved. I made a judgment call. Emergency extraction in Istanbul. 002 and 009 were the only agents available, and we needed both of them. Istanbul? Andy frowns. I was less than 2 hours' flight away. If it really was an emergency, you could have pulled me. I needed you right where you were, Em retorts. You're one of our best, Andromache, but you can't be everywhere at once. We made use of the resources we had. What was the extraction? Did they get whatever they flew out for? M sinks into her supple leather chair. For just an instant, she looks old. No. Andy crosses over to the liquor cabinet beside the desk, knowing M always keeps it well stocked, mostly for schmoozing governmental muckety-mucks, but also for discerning double O's. At least, that's what Andy assumes, since M has long since given up trying to stop her. She helps herself to some excellent gin and then drops into one of the visitor's chairs. So what did MI6 lose, apart from 009, apparently? We didn't lose him, M says crossly. He'll be right as rain in 6 to 8 weeks, according to medical. I do have a vested interest in my agent's well-being, you know. And yet you ordered Joe to take the shot. M glares at her, then pours herself a few fingers of scotch. Once she's settled back behind her desk, she swirls the liquid around her glass and sighs. I weighed the possibility of losing 009 against the certainty of losing all those other agents. I made the only decision I could. She lifts her gaze to meet Andy's. It was an encrypted computer drive containing the identity of almost every NATO agent embedded in terrorist organizations across the globe, a list which, in the eyes of our allies, never existed. It takes a long minute to sink in properly. Oh, Andy says. She drains the rest of her gin. Well, fuck. Joe spends a lot of time in the gym during the week following the Istanbul debacle. He seems to hold a personal grudge against their punching bags. He destroys at least two that Andy knows of. She keeps her distance, giving him the space to work through whatever feelings he's so desperately trying to avoid feeling. She's been there herself. She gets it. Okay, so she never put a bullet through one of her fellow agents, but still, she can understand where he's coming from, and she knows better than to offer herself up as sparring partner, at least for now. He might really hurt her without meaning to, or vice versa. Better to let him take it out on equipment that won't punch back. On day 6, Andy and Joe both get summoned to Copley's office. "We've analyzed the shrapnel fragments from 009's injuries," he says by way of introduction. Joe immediately straightens in his chair, brows drawing together. "What do you mean? We know exactly where the bullet came from. My rifle." Copley regards him steadily. "You weren't the only person shooting at 009 that day, Alcazani. His assailant on the train certainly tried. Fortunately, it wasn't a direct hit, or it might have cut DeGenova in half." He tilts one of his monitors around so that they can see the analysis. "Depleted uranium shell, military grade." "Hard to get and extremely expensive," Andy remarks with a low whistle. "Anyone we know who uses those?"
"Just a select few."
Copley taps at his keyboard and several photos pop up on the monitor. "All men," Andy notes. Well, Joe had already identified the assailant as male Caucasian, dark hair, so that probably narrowed the pool down. "Recognize anyone?" he asks Joe. Joe points to one of the photos without hesitation, murder in his eyes. "Him." "I was afraid of that," Copley grimaces. "He's the one we know the least about. Goes by Andre, likely Russian by birth, but no known ties to any nation or organization. He's a freelance operative and a bit of a ghost." Andy can see Joe's knee bouncing up and down, his whole body practically vibrating with tension beside her, like an arrow in the bowstring. "So how do we find him?" he asks. "We have a few potential sources of information." Copley meets Andy's eye and gives her an almost imperceptible nod. 007 will be taking it from here."
"What?"
Joe's hands are white-knuckled, where they grip the arms of his chair.
"This is still my mission. You can't pull me off it now."
007 is our most experienced agent, and the matter is critical. M agrees.
"He nearly killed Nikki."
"You nearly killed Nikki," Andy points out, pitching her tone to just this side of board. "This isn't a revenge tour, Joe. It's intelligence gathering." "And you're not being pulled from the original mission," Copley adds. "That hard drive is still out there. We've heard chatter about the list being up for auction on the dark web, and our priority right now is to prevent that from happening at all costs. Report to Q Branch for further instruction." Joe wavers, glancing between them both. "If this Andre has the drive..."
"That was an order, 002.
"Yes, sir," Joe spits out and goes. He just barely manages not to slam the door on his way out. Andy kicks her feet up on the chair he vacated. "I hope whatever Q gives him involves a tangible target, preferably something he can blow up." Copley rubs his temples.
"I'll see what we can do. In the meantime, we still don't know who Andre was working for in this instance, but we've compiled a dossier of his past known associates."
He passes a rather thin file across his desk. Andy thumbs through it quickly, eyebrow raised. "Not much of a list." "What it lacks in quantity, it more than makes up for in unpleasantness. You've got carte blanche on this one, Andromache. Whatever you need." She smirks. "Sounds like fun." Carte blanche means she can requisition any resources she thinks she'll need, including personnel. Some 00s don't play well with others, which is the nature of their program. Andy assiduously cultivates the few who seem capable of teamwork. For all their inexplicable mutual antipathy, both Joe and Nikki showed great promise in that area, especially when paired together. But Nikki will be out of commission for weeks yet, and Joe is clearly too volatile right now to be trusted in the field. So she goes to Booker instead. She meets him in Mombasa, in a hotel restaurant by the sea. out of your way, isn't it? He asks when she pulls up a chair. Andy hums noncommittally and slides the file across the table. On the contrary. Booker studies it, then sighs. You just don't like admitting that your French has never been up to par. He doesn't like women. Lucky for the women, Booker mutters. Remind me why we haven't put a bullet in this salaud yet. Andy smiles grimly. Because we've been saving it for a moment like this. You got this, or want me to come along and hold your hand? Somehow I'll manage. We're sure he has the intel on this André character. If we were sure, Andy says, signaling a waiter for a drink, he'd already be in MI6 custody. Fair enough. How is 009 doing, by the way? She had stopped by medical before heading back out of town, but Nikki was heavily medicated at the time, and Andy's never enjoyed watching people sleep in hospital beds. He'll bounce back. Honestly, Joe seems to be handling it much worse than Nikki at the moment. Booker shrugs philosophically, staring out at the ocean. He'll learn to carry the weight of his mistakes like the rest of us. It's that or be buried by them. Orphans make the best recruits, Zem told her. Booker's no orphan. He's a man who once had a family but no longer does. There's no simple word to describe his loss. It drove him into MI6 just as surely, though. Sometimes, when he's very, very drunk, he tells Andy about them. He's one of those who accept the promotion to 00, not in spite of the statistics, but because of them. Still, he's lasted far longer than anyone would have bet when he joined up. Less than 2 years until retirement now. Andy's rooting for him. 4 weeks of chasing leads lands them nowhere in particular. Booker's still somewhere in eastern Russia when Andy calls it and returns to London to regroup. Besides, she's earned a conjugal visit to keep her spirits up. You used to bring me gifts, Quinn sighs mock dramatically as she catches her breath. Andy grins and brushes a thumb across her nipple just to hear her squeak. My presence isn't present enough. Quinn rolls over to bite her earlobe in retaliation, which leads to a second round, followed promptly by a third. Exhibit A as to why women are so much better than men, in Andy's humble opinion. Multiple orgasms and no refractory period. Also, Quinn's skin is soft, and she smells nice. Inevitably, though, they shift into shop talk, as they always will. It's part of why they work. They form a polyamorous triad with MI6, and each member of the relationship receives equal weight. Near as we can tell, whoever currently has possession of the hard drive still hasn't had any luck decrypting it, Quinn tells her. Hence, the dark web auction. They're not looking to sell the drive. They're trying to find someone who can hack into it. Anyone out there who stands a chance at actually cracking it? Yes, a handful. She's a talented hacker in her own right, and Copley was a systems security expert before transitioning into his role as M's chief of staff, but Quinn has never been particularly ego-driven. She has no trouble admitting when someone else is better than her. Though not many of them have thrown their hats in the ring, oddly enough. I'd expected more sharks in the water, given the circumstances, but something seems to be holding them back. Andy props her head up on her hand, studying the play of moonlight across Quinn's face, or scaring them off. Quinn grimaces. That's worrying me, too. No luck with André? Lots of dead ends, literally in one case. Booker's still following one last trail. We'll see if it leads anywhere promising. She runs a hand down along the curve of Quinn's back, tracing her collarbone. Quinn hums appreciatively and snuggles in a little closer. How's Nikki's recovery coming along? I've yet to meet a 00 who does well in idleness, Quinn says dryly, but he's managing it better than most. Still has the arm in a sling, but judging by his latest marksmanship scores, shooting one-handed hasn't thrown off his aim by much. I'll check in with him while I'm in town, though I probably shouldn't drag him to the gym until the sling's off. Probably not, Quinn agrees gravely, though her eyes dance. But it would be a nice distraction for him, I think. Has he earned his name yet? Quinn's lips curve into a smirk. Jury's still out. Nikki lives in a modest flat in Bethnal Green, barely larger than a studio. Andy suspects he's had the place since long before his promotion to 00 status and the accompanying pay raise. It feels cozy and lived in, with overstuffed bookshelves taking up every available meter of wall space. He's updated the security system since the last time she broke in, but she always appreciates a challenge. She likes to keep her newer agents on their toes. There's an open bottle of white wine in the fridge, so she helps herself to a glass and curls up on his couch to wait. Nikki doesn't startle easily, which she admires on a professional level, but does privately find disappointing. It's more fun when they react. Nikki's only tells are the slight widening of his eyes and clenching of his jaw when he closes the front door and realizes he's not alone in his flat. "And the Ramaki," he says calmly, after a long moment. His uninjured arm drops loosely to his side without having reached whatever weapon he currently has concealed on his person. Her money's on a knife, probably more than one. She sips her wine. "Niccolo, you're looking better." The various cuts and bruises on his face have fully healed by this point. The sling is the only outward indication of his ordeal. He still holds himself a little gingerly, and the dark circles under his eyes are more pronounced than usual, but it could have been much worse. "How's the shoulder?" He shrugs, one-handed. "Not so bad. The ribs hurt worse most days." "That's right, you cracked a couple in the fall, didn't you? I've done that, it's a bitch." He gives her a thin smile. "As you say. Did you leave me any of that wine, or will I need to open a new one?" "Help yourself," she says, gesturing magnanimously to his fridge. Nikki huffs out a breath that isn't quite a laugh and retrieves what remains of the bottle. After a moment's consideration, he foregoes a glass and simply takes it with him to sit on the other end of the couch. "So, to what do I owe the honor?" "Just checking in," Andy says lightly. "Q says you're handling the recovery time better than most of us do." Nikki takes a swig directly from the bottle. "I suppose getting shot by a fellow agent under orders from the boss is just business as usual for a 00. Despite the words, there's no particular bitterness in his tone. Andy's not sure if his matter-of-factness is genuine, or if he's just that difficult for her to read. "You're allowed to be angry about it, you know. I fucking would be." "That sounds exhausting. Who would I even be angry with?" "M. Joe. That asshole on the train. Whoever hired him to steal the drive and started this whole mess." Andy shrugs. "Take your pick. Anger can be very cathartic if you channel it productively. God knows Joe is angry enough on your behalf." "Joe," Nikki echoes, picking at the label on the wine bottle. "Any word from him recently? I know he's been out on mission." Andy regards him over the rim of her glass. "Q says he should be reporting back in later this week. He hasn't had any more luck tracking the hard drive than we have, unfortunately." She taps her fingers against her leg, considering. "Have you seen him at all since Istanbul?" She knows that Quinn found Joe waiting outside medical that night, where he'd apparently been since the chopper brought them in, but that's as far as her intel goes. "Yes, he was there after I came out of surgery," Nikki says quietly, "and then he stopped by once more a few days later, but he seemed very..." He pauses, glance darting to Andy's face, and then back down to his own hands. "Angry, I think, like you said." His mouth twitches, a trace of humor creeping into his expression. "I am more accustomed to his temper being directed at me. It is not as easy for me to recognize when I am not his focus." "You two certainly have an interesting relationship," Andy agrees. "Have you considered fucking him to get it out of your systems?" Nikki laughs sharply and takes another long swallow. "You know, I tried that. It doesn't seem to have worked." That explains more than it doesn't, actually. She nods at the wine. "So, do you want to crack open a bottle of something stronger, or..." "I tried that already, too. It didn't really help." Yeah, but at least the hangover gives you something tangible to be miserable about.
I'm not miserable, Nikki retorts, just confused mostly. But I do not think you are here to talk about my feelings.
Not particularly, no. Andy sets her empty glass down on the coffee table and leans back against the cushions. It's a good couch.
I'm probably the last person to give that sort of advice. I shagged my way through half of MI6 in my heyday and never really thought twice about it.
Nikki tilts his head to one side, his gaze inscrutable.
Not anymore, though.
No, just Q these days.
Well,
and the occasional target, of course, but that's different. It adds a little spice to their relationship, having Quinn in her ear when she seduces a Mark, but Nikki doesn't need to know that. Andy tucks her legs under her, turning to face him fully.
Why did you join MI6 in the first place?
He's quiet for a minute. When he speaks, he's clearly trying to choose his words carefully.
I thought I might be able to do some good here, to fight for what I believe to be right.
Andy lifts an eyebrow. An idealist, then. We don't get many of those.
I know it is far more complicated than that, but still, I can try.
He shifts in his seat, wincing a little when his shoulder bumps the side of the couch.
I've always wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself, if that makes sense. And double O's are able to be more discerning in the way we run our own missions than if I'd stay with the SAS.
He smiles to himself a little ruefully.
Joe taught me that, I think, in our first mission together.
Andy frowns, trying to remember what that would have been.
When you ran interference for him in Miami?
No, it was long before we were promoted to 00 status. My first stop for MI6. We were just supposed to be doing surveillance, but there was a shootout, and my orders were to keep Joe safe. Well, really to preserve our anonymity. And his first instinct was to help the civilians instead.
Nikki shakes his head, wondering. It had never even occurred to me to question before that I might be able to assess a situation and shift my priorities accordingly, and not simply do as I was told. And it's not as though, I mean, we still have mission objectives, priorities, but here I feel as though my judgment matters as much as my sniper rifle, that my thoughts and opinions are just as important to a mission as my marksmanship. I've never found that anywhere else.
And you still feel that way? Andy asks, even after listening to M give Joe the order to take that shot.
I do. Nikki says simply, I could die at any time, on any mission. We all accept that when we accept the promotion, don't we? My own life is not more important than the lives of those we exist to protect. It can't be.
They sit with that in silence for a time. Nikki finishes what's left of the bottle.
If you're wondering why Joe is so angry right now, Andy finally says, I'm pretty sure it's because he's having trouble wrapping his head around that particular fact.
Nikki's brow creases, not quite a frown.
That his life is not more important than others.
No, she tells him, more gently than usual, that yours isn't. Because to him, it is. In Andy's early years as 007, the unofficial physical trainer for the 00s was 004, a suave Adonis of a man named Achilles. He had the body and sexual appetites of a Greek god, and more than one of Andy's sparring sessions with him devolved into a different sort of wrestling. She liked to joke later that he'd ruined her for all other men. Women were still better, though. She can't call what they had a love affair, though she'd certainly cared for him in her way and trusted him to have her back in the field, which was far more important. But by God, the sex was fantastic. Achilles died on an op in the Australian outback 3 years before mandatory retirement. Spider bite of all the damn things. His successor as 004 was slender and sharp-eyed, and Andy got on with him well enough, but she never sparred with him. He didn't last long enough as a 00 to be worth missing. By the next 004, Andy was in charge of hand-to-hand training. She doesn't fuck in the gym anymore, but Achilles certainly isn't the only fellow agent she slept with. It's fun, it's physical, it's release from a job that consumes all their waking hours, that will dog them to their graves. They live hard and die young. Why not milk all the joy out of it while you can? It's not that the new Q changed all that for Andy. She'd already been slowing down by the time the old quartermaster retired. She turned 40 and realized that maybe she had a shot of surviving this gig after all. Maybe she should start figuring out what after might look like. Quinn makes her feel like it's something to look forward to. Okay, she and Quinn did shag in the gym, just the once, though, and Quinn was very diligent about scrubbing all evidence from the CCTV afterwards. Booker and Joe both get back to London within hours of each other. Joe is still empty-handed, having worn out another useless trail trying to hunt down the current location of the hard drive. Booker, however, has workable intel. Andre will be in Sao Paulo in 2 days' time, he reports to M. He, Andy, Joe, and Copley have convened in M's office for this particular debrief, probably on a job. My bet is that it's related to this dark web auction somehow, but I don't have hard confirmation of that. Copley steeples his fingers. Still, it's the best lead we've had yet. All right. It's more than a 12-hour flight to Sao Paulo. Andromache will need to get you in the air as soon as possible. If he turns up, he's yours, M tells her. Find out who he works for and who has the drive, then terminate him. Andy inclines her head with a razor-sharp smile. It feels good to finally be taking a step forward. Booker will remain in place to coordinate any further intelligence we receive, Copley goes on. As for you, Alcazani, I'm accompanying her to Sao Paulo, Joe says, in a tone that dares anyone to gainsay him. If that's where this Andre will be, that's where I'm going. Copley glances to M, who gives him the barest of nods. Fine, Copley says, but 007 takes the lead on this, you understand? She gives you an order, you follow it. Joe gives Andy a sidelong glance, almost a smirk. Just like training. Yeah, boss, I got it. Once the logistics have been agreed upon, M dismisses the group, but gestures for Andy to linger for a moment. They wait for the door to close behind the men. Keep your eyes open, 007, she says quietly. Andre is nothing but a bit player in this drama. I can't help but feel we're chasing our own tails here. Don't lose sight of the bigger picture. Unlike Joe, Andy thinks. Aloud, she says, Q thinks they haven't managed to decrypt the drive yet. M purses her lips. Occam's razor. We assume they haven't because we know if they had. I don't find that particularly comforting. Especially since we don't know who they are, Andy agrees. Which is a clue in and of itself, M murmurs, isn't it? Quinn doesn't treat Andy any differently than any other agents when outfitting her for a mission. No differently than she did before they were together. She's brisk and professional and cuttingly sarcastic, exactly as Andy likes her best, scolding her in advance for the expensive equipment she's sure to destroy. And Andy lets her because it's the only way this can continue to work between them. This mission is no more dangerous or fraught than any other. She's no more likely to die today than she was yesterday or tomorrow. She's a 00. This is what she does. If Andy trails her fingertip along the inside of Quinn's wrist as she accepts her documentation, so very gently, neither of them remark upon it. Winter in Sao Paulo doesn't feel noticeably different than summer in London. It's probably more reliably warm here and less prone to chilly rainstorms. There's also a different flavor to the humidity, which Andy can never quite pin down. She and Joe were on the same flight, direct from London, but seated separately. In the airport, they pass each other like strangers and take different routes to the hotel. It's nothing too extravagant, your standard business traveler's destination. They check in more than an hour apart, Andy stashes her luggage in her own room and then takes the service stairwell down two flights to Joe's. She knocks his name in Morse code just for shits and giggles. "Very funny," he tells her when he opens the door. "I prefer the old shave and a haircut myself." She breezes past him to make a beeline for his minibar. Boring. After a moment's consideration, she grabs a couple of small vodka bottles, proffering one to Joe. He shakes his head. "I don't drink on missions, or much at all, really." "More for me, then," she says affably, plopping down onto the little love seat that probably claims to be a couch. "I never thought to ask. Do you keep halal in general?" Joe shrugs, perching at the foot of his bed, sort of. More out of habit than piety at this point, to be honest. And it's not always an option in the field. "Yeah, I can imagine." She cracks open the bottle cap and takes a brisk gulp. It burns nicely all the way down the back of her throat. "Booker will let us know when we have an ETA on Andre's arrival tomorrow. Think he'd recognize your face?" Joe hesitates. "Maybe." "Not definitely. Nikki was the one who got up close and personal with him. I was just the driver. But it's possible. I certainly got a good enough look at his." "That's what I thought. All right. I'll get eyes on him at the airport then. You'll keep the car running so that we can tail him." "And then what?" "If we're lucky, he'll check into a hotel somewhere first, and we can finish this in private. If not," she shrugs, "we improvise." He gives her a pale imitation of a smile. "My specialty." Andy rolls her eyes. "Yeah, you and every other 00. That's what gets us the promotion." "Not Nikki," Joe says, his tone unreadable. She really hadn't intended to talk about whatever the hell is going on between him and Nikki, but here they are. "He's more of a by-the-book than most, but he knows when to make it count," she says, sprawling back against the scratchy cushions. "Anyway, that's part of what makes you an effective team in the field, complementary skill sets. Why do you think you keep getting paired together on ops?" Joe's eyes widen, but he quickly looks down and away, plucking at the coverlet. "Guess that wasn't such a good idea." "What happened in Istanbul had nothing to do with how you two work together," Andy says bluntly. "It was a shit call on Em's part. She should have trusted that Nikki would get the job done, and you need to stop second-guessing yourself and move past it. Nikki has." Joe shakes his head, more reflex than actual denial. "How can he trust me to have his back after that?" "Have you actually talked to him about it?" "Sort of." Joe rubs the back of his neck. "He was doped up on painkillers in medical. I'm not going to hold him to..." "I don't know." "That was weeks ago, though," Andy points out. "He's certainly of sound mind now. You really haven't seen him since?" "I was out on mission, you know that. And it's not like I had much time between the debrief and our flight. I barely even saw my own flat." He blows out a breath, not meeting her eyes. "Anyway, it's complicated." Andy sips her vodka. "Because you're shagging him?" That gets him to look at her, at least. His head comes up like a startled horse. "What? No. It was only the once, anyway. And how did..." "You know what? Never mind. I should just assume you know everything." She gives him what she's been told is her most unsettling smile. "You can't possibly think you're the first to fuck a fellow 00. We're kind of infamous for it." He barks out a hollow laugh. "If only it were that simple." "It's only as complicated as you make it," she counters. "You know, when I first became 007, two of the others were a married couple. Individually, they were both solid agents, but together..." She shakes her head in fond reminiscence. "It was like poetry in motion watching them work. They were a fucking force to be reckoned with." "So what happened to them?" Joe clearly expects some kind of tragedy. "Nothing," Andy says simply. "They were the only two agents in my original cohort who made it to retirement. Last I heard, they'd opened some kind of mixed martial arts gym up in Manchester." She finishes the tiny bottle of vodka and sets it aside. "But that's why I started bullying M to assign multiple agents on the more complex ops. I saw how well it worked for them." Joe is quiet for long moments. Finally, he says heavily, Nikki and I aren't like that.
Not yet, maybe, but you could be. Andy gets to her feet, tucking the second mini bottle into her pocket.
Look, I really don't give a shit if you sleep with him again or not. But once we're back in London, just talk to him, will you? You're both grown-ups. Deal with your goddamn feelings already. We've got more important shit to worry about.
She leaves him, still sitting motionless at the foot of his hotel bed, staring out at nothing in particular.
Andre's flight lands at 9:14 p.m. the next evening. Dressed as a businessman and toting a metallic briefcase, he doesn't stand out in a crowd, useful for his line of work. Andy follows him unobtrusively out of the arrivals gate and into the taxi queue. Joe is waiting at the curb in a black sedan. Andy slips into the back seat. The silence between them as they follow Andre's taxi thrums with tension, both feeling the slow burn of adrenaline that characterizes any mission. For all that, Joe keeps a steady hand at the wheel, weaving smoothly in and out of traffic, keeping the taillights of the cab in sight at all times. It's late on a Sunday evening, and as the cab makes its way into the heart of Sao Paulo's business district, the streets grow emptier, though still busy enough that their car doesn't stand out. It's slightly harder to remain unobtrusive when Andre disembarks from the taxi and sets off briskly down a one-way street. Wherever he's bound, he's enough of a professional not to want the cabbie to connect him with his actual destination. Still, Joe's a good driver, and he manages to follow him, only losing him once for half a block or so. Eventually, Andre pushes through the revolving door of an unexceptional office building. The lobby is floor-to-ceiling glass plate windows. From where their car idles across the street, Andy and Joe can clearly see when Andre pulls a silenced pistol from his jacket and shoots the lone security guard neatly in the chest, then drags his body out of sight behind the reception desk.
Shit, Joe says.
Guess we'll have to improvise after all. Andy's already moving. Keep your comm open and get to the roof. I'll follow him inside and let you know what floor. She doesn't wait to see if he'll obey. Inside, the office building is dark and still, showing no signs of life. The only sounds are distant street traffic and the faint ding of the lift arriving. Light footsteps and then the doors whooshing quietly shut. The last thing Andy needs is for Andre to notice another elevator in use in what should be an empty skyscraper. So she watches for the ascending numbers to come to a stop, waits another minute for good measure, then bolts for the nearest staircase.
23rd floor, she informs Joe, pitching her voice low even in the stairwell. This place is deserted. He'll hear us coming from a mile away if we're not careful.
I think I have an idea about that, he says. And if she were anyone else, that particular tone of voice might make her nervous. But she's been a 00 for nearly 15 years, and the thought just makes her grin savagely as she races up the stairs. I hope Q outfitted you appropriately for the occasion.
She can practically hear Joe's answering grin.
Oh, she definitely did. Any idea which side of the building he'll be on?
You've got the better vantage point. Make an educated guess.
There aren't many jobs Andre might take that would put him in a building like this at this particular time of night. And from what little intel they have, he's not the corporate espionage type. It takes Joe a few beats longer to reach the same conclusion.
Northeast corner, he says finally. That's where I'd set up a sniper nest. It faces the only neighboring building of similar height, and I see lights on several floors across the street.
Mixed use, residential, big glass windows. Andy, this is a hit job.
Looks like, she agrees.
She's at the 10th floor now, beginning to regret her life choices. Sure, she's in excellent shape, but sprinting up 23 flights of stairs is not her idea of a good time.
There's quiet for the next couple of flights, and then Joe asks, are we trying to prevent that?
If we can. Might not be possible, though.
It's never a call she likes to make, but we prioritize getting the intel.
Deep down, she knows they're not going to make it in time to stop whatever assassination Andre has planned. They might interrupt it if they throw caution to the winds, but that will just warn Andre that he's been made, and he'll disappear again. And he's not spending yet another month trying to chase him down. Every day they wait is a day closer to the hard drive being decrypted and those agents being exposed. Don't lose sight of the bigger picture. It galls her to know that some anonymous stranger is going to die tonight, and she won't be able to prevent it, but at least she can avenge them. She loses a few more precious seconds at the landing on the 23rd floor, getting her breathing under control. Once she's sure her own gasping breaths won't give her away, she pushes the stairwell door open as silently as she can and slips out into the corridor. Everything seems made of glass, an open office nightmare layout. Fuck all modernist office architects. On the plus side, it won't be difficult to find Andre, even though she only has the ambient light from the street to guide her. The problem, of course, is that he'll be able to see her just as easily if she's not careful. She moves in shadows, keeping her tread light and gait smooth. Neon light from some advertisement across the avenue tinges the empty office in pinks and reds and whites, then fades back out to darkness again. Joe's instincts were good. She glimpses another shadow at work in the northeast corner of the floor. Directly across the street, she can clearly see the layout of a wealthy residence, all rich gold tones and black velvets, not at all her style. Two men are seated at a dining table, both in suits and ties. There's a woman in the room, too, darker skin than either of the men, elaborate braids crowning her head. She's wearing an emerald green dress that gleams in the warm lamplight and hugs her curves in all the right places. The vision catches Andy for a moment, transfixes her. An odd whistling sound snaps her out of her mild reverie. It takes her a moment to place it. Wind. Andre has cut a hole in the window, and the wind is whistling through it. She doesn't dare speak into the comm, knowing any sound will alert him to her presence, so she taps out a quick Morse code message instead. Now. She drops down to a crouch well off to the side. She only knows that Andre takes the shot when the entire glass window of the room in the building opposite them shatters from the force of it. One of the men slumps forward onto the table. The other leaps to his feet. The woman dives behind the table and out of sight more quickly than Andy would have thought possible in that tight of a dress. Andy mentally approves her instincts. As the second man dies from Andre's second shot, the plate glass window of their office shatters with a hail of bullets, and Joe swings inside. Apparently, Q outfitted him with a grappling hook and ample quantity of rope. Good for her. Joe had aimed the bullets high, not wanting to kill Andre before they could get information out of him, glass being what it is, though. Shards fly everywhere. Andy avoids the worst of it, out of the way as she is, and the time for stealth has passed. She leaps into the fray. Andre is already wrestling with Joe, bleeding freely from a number of gashes which don't seem to be slowing him down much. And unlike them, he's not hampered by the need to keep them alive a little bit longer. It's a dangerous dance for Andy and Joe. It would be so much easier to just put a bullet in the back of his head and end this, but they have to fight to disable, not kill, not just yet. In the end, it doesn't matter how careful they are. Andy finally wrenches the rifle out of Andre's grip and he staggers backward, which is when they all realize exactly how close to the edge of the shattered floor-to-ceiling window they are. Andre loses his balance. Joe just barely manages to catch his wrist as he falls, but it's not enough. "Who has the drive?" Joe shouts over the wind, trying to keep his grip on the assassin's hand. Andy wraps her arms around Joe's waist from behind to prevent him from falling out himself. "Who are you working for?" Andre never answers. His hand slips out of Joe's grasp, and he falls. 23 flights. There's no point in going after him. "Still," Joe swears expressively under his breath as he lets Andy tug him back to safety, then bolts back toward the stairwell. Andy lets him. She understands being driven by that kind of helpless fury. She just crouches in the debris for a beat, catching her breath. When she glances up, she can see the carnage in the opulent apartment across the street. Two dead men sprawl inelegantly across the table. The woman in the green dress is standing beside them, one hand pressed to her hip, staring right back at Andy. Her expression is utterly unreadable. Her dark eyes are fathomless. Andy meets her gaze for several long moments. Then the woman gives a start, half turning in response to something further within the apartment, and Andy doesn't lose another second, just grabs for the silver briefcase Andre left behind. By the time the woman in green can turn back to look again, Andy is gone. The silver briefcase was built to hold all the equipment Andre needed to carry out his hit. Sniper rifle, spare ammunition, the glass cutter, assorted other tools. No hint as to who hired him. Very professional. Any clue who the men he killed might have been? Andy asked Quinn. They've got a video call set up. Good luck to anyone trying to hack into one of Q's laptops. Quinn looks tired, even accounting for the unflattering fluorescent lighting in Q Branch. Not yet. I put feelers out to our cousins, since it's their side of the pond and all. The distaste is evident in her tone. She hates going begging to the Americans. But she's right. The CIA has a lot more resources in play in this part of the world. Andy may not like them, but it's not like she can claim any sort of moral superiority. They did learn how to play at imperialism from their own British forebears, after all. On her good day, she tries to think of her job as an attempt to clean up the mess her country made of the world. On bad ones, she worries they're just exacerbating the problem, but still she has to try. "Making the world safer for you, my love," her mother's voice whispers. Andy waves aside the wisp of memory. "What about the woman who is with them? She survived the shooting. She might know more." "If you can track her down, be my guest. Pretty, was she?" Q's eyes gleam. Andy gives her a tired grin. "Very. You'd have appreciated her, I think. Excellent taste in gowns." "Well, whatever you feel is necessary," Quinn teases, then sobers. "How's 002 doing?" "Very pissed off that we didn't get anything out of Andre, and blaming himself for it." "Was it his fault?" Andy props her chin on her hand. "No more his than mine. Just how the fight played out. He's just invested in this one." "Oh, Andromache," Quinn says with a fleeting smile, "as though you are not." It's just about noon local time when Quinn arranges a meet with her CIA contact. Not technically her contact, Andy clarifies, catching Joe up to speed as they make their way to one of the tackier tourist districts, but an operative in the area who's willing to trade intel. "I wasn't aware we had any information worth trading," Joe remarks, flipping his cap backwards on his head. A few stray curls poke out the gap above the closure. Andy shrugs. "They know something about the guys who got killed last night. We know who did the killing. Seems like a fair swap to me. Everyone involved is dead anyway." "There is that." She doesn't know Sao Paulo very well, but she's guessing this is the red light district or something similar, near enough to the main tourist drags to attract straying husbands or assholes on business trips. They slip into one of the few bars on the block that doesn't look like a strip club. The interior feels shockingly dark in contrast to the bright sunshine outside, and it looks like the decor hasn't been updated since the 60s, but at least it's clean enough. This early in the afternoon, there's not much action, just a handful of patrons, mostly men, likely grabbing a drink on their lunch break. An ancient TV over the bar plays local news, recapping some sporting event. Joe claims a rickety table in a corner while Andy heads for the bar. She orders a couple of beers, mostly just to blend in. As best they can, anyway. While the bartender pops the caps, the woman on the nearest stool says in accented Portuguese, "I'll have what she's having." Andy glances over curious and instantly recognizes the woman in the green dress, the one who'd survived Andre's assassination. She's not in a fancy outfit today, of course. She's dressed down in jeans and a green and white jacket. Her braids aren't pinned up in a crown anymore. instead streaming down her back. She manages to look just as regal in streetwear as she had in the ball gown, though. This is obviously no coincidence. Andy pays for them both and gets a smirk in return. Big spender, huh? The woman teases, in English this time, American accent. Oh, Andy should have known. The American clinks her beer against Andy's. Thanks for the drink, cousin. And that confirms it. Care to join us? Since we're apparently related and all. You know it. Joe's had eyes on them the whole time. He gives Andy a smile that doesn't reach his eyes as they take their seats around his table. Making friends? The American proffers her hand. Niall Freeman, a cousin from Langley. He shakes it. Joe, and of course you've met Andy. You could say that. Niall glances sidelong at her, eyes sharp. I've heard rumors about you folk, you know. Your penchant for dramatics. Andy gives her a sliver of a smile. I hope we lived up to the hype. Oh, last night was dramatic, all right. Not sure how effective it was, though. Be fair, Andy says mildly. We did save your life. Niall rolls her eyes. You ruined a perfectly good interrogation, is what you did. You couldn't have eliminated your shooter before he assassinated my target. Interrogation? That looked more like an intimate dinner party to me. Oh, it was a party, all right, Niall sighs. I was this close. He was practically eating out of the palm of my hand. Sounds delicious. Who was he again? Niall takes a swallow of beer. When she sets the bottle down, she's all business. Never got his real name, just a bunch of different aliases. Doesn't much matter now. You know that hard drive your people lost went up for auction 2 days ago, right? Joe swears creatively. We knew it was happening, but not when, Andy confirms. How did Langley get wind of it? NSA caught the chatter and decided to play nice for a change, Niall says. This is NATO's dirty laundry you hung out to dry, not just British spies. A few of our people are likely on that list, too. You're not the only ones with skin in this game. Joe leans forward. So the men Andre assassinated last night, they were involved in this auction? Well, one was just a bodyguard, Niall says wryly, though apparently not a very good one. My target, though, yeah. He's the one who set the auction up in the first place. So he was a hacker? Andy asks. Yes and no. More of a broker. But this Andre character, the killer, from what my handler told me, you think he's working for whoever stole the drive? He stole the drive in the first place, Joe confirms. We still don't know who he was paid to steal it for, though. Still, you think he and the broker would have been on the same side, if they're both working for whoever has the drive now. So why kill him? Joe rubs the back of his neck, frowning. Andre was a mercenary. Maybe he wasn't working for them anymore. Or they're tying up loose ends. Andy rolls her empty bottle idly between her hands, thinking it through. The auction already happened. They got what they wanted. Now they've killed the one guy on the outside who seems to have known all about it. Niall pulls a face. You know, I really wish you'd gotten rid of Andre before he took that shot. If we'd known who he was aiming for, we would have, Andy says darkly. They sit with it in silence for a bit. Andy helps herself to Joe's beer since he clearly has no use for it. Well, I definitely need another drink, Niall finally says. Be right back. As she makes her way back to the bar, Andy and Joe regard each other grimly. Now what, boss? Joe asks. Andy leans back in her rickety chair with a sigh. Fucked if I know. We'll talk Niall through what she got from her guy before the shooting, see if there's any pieces we're missing. At first, Andy notices the low buzz but doesn't really register it. Then she realizes her phone is vibrating in her pocket. She reaches for it instinctively, while across the table Joe is frowning, similarly distracted. When she glances down at the mobile screen, though, she doesn't see a message or a call, just a blank screen. No, not blank. Black. The mobile vibrates again, flashing white 3 times, then going black again. She knows, before she even tries, that she won't be able to use it for anything else. It's completely dead, and not because it ran out of battery. She grabs Joe's arm and hauls him upright while he's still blinking down at his own Q-branch issue, totally dead mobile. He's new. He's never gotten a blackout order before. If they'd been active on the comm to Q-branch, they would have received it in Morse instead, but it means the same thing. Blackout, Andy says grimly. She drops her useless mobile to the floor and steps down on it hard with the heel of her boot. We've got to go. Joe's face goes a shade paler than usual, but he nods and follows her lead. Blackout means they have to assume their mission is compromised, and so are their communications. It means drop everything and get to a safe house ASAP. The last time a blackout order was issued was when the former 002, Keen, had defected from MI6 and attempted to murder Lycan. It doesn't bode well. Niall, Joe says, catching at Andy's arm, we should... Andy doesn't point out that Niall might be the reason they're compromised, because anything is possible. She doesn't really think that, though, and before she can respond, Niall herself appears before them again, eyes wide. Guys, she says a little shakily, you should come look at the TV. In spite of all her training, Andy glances back at the bar where the crotchety old TV broadcasts breaking news, a live image of smoke billowing out from a massive scorched hole that used to be the top floor of MI6 headquarters in London. Hey, can you turn that up? Niall calls to the bartender. He shrugs and complies. No one has yet claimed responsibility for what could now be a possible cyber terrorist assault on the British Secret Service. Early reports from the scene indicate at least 6 dead, many more injured, with victims being evacuated to local hospitals. Oh, God, Andy murmurs, feeling the bottom drop out of her stomach. M. Copley. Q. She's dimly aware of Joe grasping her hand and laces her fingers tightly with his, but doesn't hear a word he's saying, barely even registering the low, rough tenor of his voice in her ear. Oh, no. The first time she met the woman who would become M, Andy was 15 and about to be expelled from her third boarding school in as many years. For fighting this time, probably. Not like she was the only overprivileged little shit in this posh nightmare of a school to throw a punch at another student. But when Andy got into fights, she always won them, decisively. She was summoned to the headmaster's office, but this time it wasn't just the old coot behind his desk. There was a woman with him, petite and round-faced, silver threading her short dark hair. At the time, Andy assumed she was just as ancient as the sour-faced headmaster, but in retrospect, she probably wasn't even 50 yet. She was small and contained in a way that made Andy, already taller than most of the boys in her year, feel herself to be all awkward elbows and knees. The headmaster read her a lecture, which Andy only half heard, and introduced the stranger as one of the school's governors. Andy didn't bother remembering her name. Ironic, that. And then he just exited his own office with one last glower and harumph, leaving Andy alone with the woman. I've never been expelled by a governor before, Andy informed her. I must have really ticked off someone's daddy this time. The woman smiled. It was a brisk, appreciative sort of smile, not the cloying kind Andy associated with people who'd heard about the poor orphan dear or the smug, self-righteous smirk of an adult about to teach her what was what. I certainly hope so, the woman said. I hope the bastard got what was coming to him. It startled Andy into a smile of her own. Absolutely, she agreed. The boy in question this time had been paying the fourth formers to suck him off behind the garden shed. He definitely deserved it. Good, the woman said. I'm not here to expel you, Andromache. I'm an old friend of your mother's. Andy stiffened. My mother's dead. Yes, I know. I was with her when she was killed. That came as a bit of a shock. The woman, not yet known as M, gave Andy a sharp, assessing look. She didn't soften her tone in the slightest, which Andy appreciated. You were what, 9 years old when she died? Andy nodded. That must have been very difficult. Did your mother ever tell you what she did for a living? Not in so many words, but Andy had more or less put it together by 15 anyway. She said she was making the world safer, she said, with no small amount of bitterness. She certainly tried to, yes, Em said, and she was very good at it. But I think one day you could be better. I've seen your records. You're clearly smarter than any teacher who's had the misfortune of trying to educate you, and you'd never back down from a fight. As one of the governors of this esteemed institution, she added, voice bone dry, I should perhaps reprimand you for that, but I've never had much patience for polite lies. Get yourself expelled by all means. I don't much care, but I'm going to arrange for you to sit your A-levels later this spring regardless. Once you have those, and I've no doubt you'll perform admirably in spite of yourself, God knows you have the brains for it, you can walk into any university you choose. I'll see to that. She folded her hands over her lap, looking Andy up and down. I would avoid the Oxbridge set if I were you. Pick somewhere out of the way where you can tailor your own course of study. I have people in most of the better colleges. Do you speak any languages beyond English and whatever miserable Latin this place drummed into you? We spoke German at home, Andy pointed out, in that language. Em nodded in clear understanding. And I can get by in French and Greek as well. Well, it's a good start, and you seem to have an ear for them. Political science wouldn't go amiss either, nor would history. But you'll figure that out for yourself, I'm sure. Em stood and offered her hand. Andy shook it, head still spinning a little. And the martial arts are an excellent way to work off some of that excess energy of yours, by the way. What, like judo or something? Or something, Em said, with another one of those small, brisk smiles. I'm glad we could have this chat, Andromache. I look forward to seeing what you make of yourself. Under normal circumstances, not that a blackout order is ever normal, there's a specific protocol agents are supposed to follow. Each of the up to 9 active 00 agents has their own designated safe house within a few hours' travel of London. Only M, Q, and the agent know the location of that safe house. They're not even supposed to share that information with one another, since one of the nightmare blackout scenarios is the willing defection of a 00. Once they reach their safe house, they are to remain in place and await further instructions. Andy's only had to follow that protocol twice in all her years as an active agent. The first had been mere months after she joined MI6, the London underground bombings, an overabundance of caution on M's part, but who could blame her? Andy honestly can't remember what caused the second instance, some compromised communication line, she thinks, that had seemed more serious than it actually turned out to be. She thinks that incident had eventually led to their old quartermaster's retirement. He'd never been quite up to speed on cybersecurity. And now this. Fuck protocol, she tells Joe bluntly. We're sticking together. Assuming Q made it through, and it's a fucking miracle her voice doesn't break at that, she'll reach out to my safe house first. Joe agrees without hesitation. So where are we going? Just outside of Paris. Fuck. I don't want to trust to a commercial flight, not if our current documentation might be compromised. Somehow they haven't shaken Niall off yet. I can help with that, she says quietly, if you're willing to trust me. Andy and Joe exchange a quick glance. If MI6 is compromised, your agency might be too, Andy does have to point out. Niall shrugs. Probably not, if it's related to the hard drive or auction. For once, that shit didn't come out of our house. Beggars can't be choosers, Joe murmurs. Andy, we need to get home. Yeah, Andy says, giving Niall a firm nod. All right. She wants to call Quinn. The need so intense, her hands are shaking with it. Just to hear her voice, just for a second. She can't. Niall manages to acquire them a smallish Cessna for the flight to Paris. It's smaller than your average private jet and not particularly luxurious, but it's private and the pilot is willing to take them exactly where they want to go, so long as Niall tags along as escort. CIA has its perks, huh? Joe says, as he flops into his seat. "They definitely don't put out like this when it's just me," Niall replies. "But I guess my boss wants to impress your boss. It's always nice having MI6 owe us a favor." Langley has been panting over a few particular items of Q's design for ages, and he can guess what the favor will be. She hopes it's worth it. Joe is twitchy and restless for the first couple of hours, but eventually he nods off in his seat. Andy's a little jealous. It's a long flight with nothing to do but worry herself into knots, and she hates feeling helpless. Also, there's no minibar on this plane. "You okay over there?" Niall asks, taking out her earbuds. Andy had thought she'd been asleep too, but apparently not. "You look like you're trying to make the plane move faster with the sheer force of your glare." Andy sighs. "I just hate not knowing what's going on." "I don't blame you. Just seeing that on TV. You got people you care about who work in that building, right?" "Everyone I care about in the world," Andy says quietly. Niall's brow creases. "You don't have any family?" "They are my family. My partner works for MI6, my mentor, my friends, even annoying little brother," she adds with a nod toward Joe, still sleeping soundly across the aisle. "Not by blood, but family, all the same." "I guess I get that," Niall says slowly. "I did a tour in the Marines, straight out of high school. The other girls in my unit, we were tight like that. But the CIA, that's just a job. It can be pretty all-consuming," she adds ruefully. "But still, I try to keep it separate." "That's probably healthier in a lot of ways," Andy acknowledges. "But this has been my life for a long time." She studies Niall's face, considering. "You've got a family, then?" "My mom and my brother," Niall says. She hesitates, then switches seats so that she's next to Andy instead of across from her. And assorted aunties and cousins and shit, of course. "But the three of us have always been a unit, you know?" Andy hums agreement. "My mother and I were like that when I was young. The two of us against the world. But she died when I was still a kid, so..." Niall is nodding. "My dad was killed in action when I was 11. My mom, she was drowning after he died. South side of Chicago. A million different ways it could have went left. She fought for us. Never backed down. Never let us back down either." She fiddles with her MP3 player, like she wishes it were a phone. Bad protocol to take personal mobiles out in the field, of course. They're far too easy to track. "That's why I joined up after high school. Honor my dad's memory, follow his footsteps, try to make the world a little safer, you know?" Something catches in Andy's throat, twists, and sticks there. "Making the world safer for you, my love," she remembers. "But also, orphans make the best recruits." "You come from warriors," is what she says aloud. Niall smiles a little. "Yeah, I do." She props her elbow up on the armrest, resting her cheek in her hand, studying Andy with curious sympathy. "What happened to your mom?" "She was a field agent for MI6 in the last years of the Cold War," Andy says. "We lived in East Berlin for most of my early childhood. She died on and off a few months before the Berlin Wall fell." "Wow," Niall says. "So this work really does run in your blood, huh?" Andy shrugs. "Like you said, we follow in their footsteps in our own ways, honor their legacy. The world has changed so much in the past 30 years, sometimes I wonder if she'd even recognize it." She taps her fingers against the armrest, staring out the narrow window. Nothing but ocean, as far as the eye can see. "It's still my mother's mission, though." After a beat, Niall rests her hand on Andy's arm, squeezing gently just for a moment. "We'll get you back to it, I promise." They land in a private airstrip outside of Paris a little after dawn, and the CIA agent who meets them there provides them with a clean car, an unremarkable dark gray sedan. "Here's where we leave you," Niall tells Andy and Joe, all business again in front of her colleagues. "Good luck, cousins." Andy clasps her arm warmly. "We'll be seeing you around, I hope." "Not if I see you first," Niall replies with a wink. It's a relatively short drive from the airstrip to Andy's safe house. an abandoned church in Goosenville, but every minute feels like hours. Joe's wide awake and twitchy again, drumming his fingers against the dash until she swats at him to stop. "Sorry," he says, not sounding it. I know. He runs his hand through his hair, which is already a bit of a bird's nest from his nap on the plane. Even if the building damage was contained to the initial blast radius, he says, the words scraping low like gravel in his throat, that's still the executive offices, at the very least. M. Copley, their aides. And Booker's been holed up with Copley running intel for our mission. And if there are any other double O's not out on mission. Nikki, he doesn't say. But she knows he's thinking it. If she were Copley, she certainly would have brought Nikki in on this one. He's healed enough for desk work and too sharp to be content sitting at home when there's intel to gather on his own failed op. Don't borrow trouble, she says gruffly. We'll know soon enough. Joe slants a glance over at her, visibly contrite. Andy, I'm sorry. Q. Is most likely fine and mad as hell that someone dared breach her security systems, Andy interrupts. Q branch is down in the basement levels. Even if the explosion was significantly worse than what we saw at TV, she would have been able to evacuate in time. That's what she's been repeating to herself for hours now, like a mantra. The building would have been evacuated immediately following the blast. Those on the lower levels, at least, should have gotten out safely. Horrible to think of it that way, as though she's mentally trading Quinn's life for Copley's or M's, but she can hate herself for it later. They're quiet for the rest of the brief drive. Andy parks the car in the wooded area near the church at the end of a dirt track. It's relatively isolated from the actual village of Goosenville and long since abandoned. The roar of a jet passing overhead makes Joe start a little, then shake his head. Guess I know why this place isn't so popular anymore, he remarks. She gives him a thin smile in reply. As they emerge from the woods to the little cemetery behind the church itself, they both tense at once. There's another vehicle parked near the vestry. Fortunately, it only takes Andy another 10 seconds to recognize the battered old Citroën. She'd know that rust bucket anywhere. Booker, she tells Joe with a grin. It feels like the first time she's properly smiled in days. And he'd only be here if Q sent him. Joe exhales in a noisy rush and reholsters his Walther. Alhamdulillah. The vestry is the best entrance to the safe house. The main church doors have long since been boarded up. Andy pounds hard on the door in a specific pattern she and Booker use on their joint ops, then shoves it open. Inside is cool and dim, as always. She's only been here a handful of times over the years. Still, she's rather fond of her strange old church. There's a certain stillness, the way the early morning light filters through mostly boarded-up stained-glass windows, that calms her in a way she can't quite describe. All the pews have long since been cleared out, and a makeshift living space set up in their place. Andy! Booker jumps up from an armchair, relief clear in his face. He tugs her into a rough one-armed hug, the most affection he's ever been willing to show. You good? I am now, she tells him, giving the back of his neck a quick squeeze before releasing him. Please tell me Q sent you. Of course she did. She's fine, Andy, he says, voice low and sincere, spitting mad and stuck under an extremely onerous security detail until the worst of this blows over, but she wasn't hurt, not a scratch. Andy has to close her eyes for a minute and just breathe it in. It's like all of her muscles have been tensed up for days, coiled far too tightly, and now they've released all at once. It's a wonder she doesn't stagger with it. Joe, good to see you, Booker goes on, giving her the space she obviously needs, and she is briefly, intensely grateful for it. Joe claps his shoulder amiably, but his own face is still drawn. Book, hey, glad you made it out okay. Do you know? His voice cuts off so abruptly that it pulls Andy out of her own head for an instant. She looks up to see Nikki appear in the doorway of the sectioned-off sleeping area. His arm is still in a sling. Well, of course it is. It's only been, what, a week since she last saw him, if that. Christ, it feels like it's been months.
Hello, Nicky tells them both, corners of his eyes crinkling in what might even be a smile.
Q thought I'd be better off staying with Booker, in case you needed help.
Joe makes an odd, strangled sort of noise. Then he's moving so fast it's unreal, practically tackling Nicky into a full-body hug, somewhat mindful of the injured shoulder.
Nicky looks startled at first, then leans into it, wrapping his good arm around Joe in turn and pressing his cheek to Joe's, his eyes slipping shut.
So, that's happening, apparently.
Andy snorts and turns back to Booker, jerking her head toward the table. He covers a grin with his hand and follows her there. Andy settles into a chair with a sigh.
What's the damage? She asks him quietly.
Booker sobers at once, expression going grim. Body count is up to 11, and there are still a few more in critical condition. The explosion originated with M's own fucking computer. I don't know the technical details, but the long and short of it is we got hacked, and they turned our own security countermeasures against us. Q and Copley are neck deep in it still. We're lucky Q figured out what was happening the instant it started and was able to fend off the worst of it from her laptop in a stairwell of all the damn things.
Andy huffs out of breath.
There was worse than that to fend off? I saw the news report.
They hacked into the environmental control system, locked out the safety protocols, and turned on the gas, Booker says flatly.
Q managed to contain the damage to where it originated in the executive suite. The whole building could have gone otherwise, and she ensured that the data breach didn't get beyond.
He grimaces, mouth twisting.
The stolen hard drive, Andy says heavily. That's how they're getting into the list itself, by hacking the decryption codes directly from M's own computer.
Seems like.
By now, Joe and Nicky have joined them, standing a respectable meter or so apart. Nicky's cheeks look a little flushed, and Joe is studiously not looking in his direction. It would be adorable if the circumstances weren't so fucking grim.
Who'd we lose? Joe asks quietly.
You mentioned Copley and Q were all right.
They were both down in Q Branch when it happened. Same as me and Nicky, Booker confirms.
Most of the dead were executive aides, one field agent, a member of the cleaning staff, and well.
He meets Andy's eyes, his own sorrowful.
M. She was in her office.
I'm sorry, she didn't make it out.
Andy breathes in and then out again.
She knew it already, she thinks.
She's known since she saw that shot on the TV in Sao Paulo.
Orphans make the best recruits.
M was never any kind of a mother figure.
Not to Andy.
But is there really much difference? She's the reason all four of them are here together now. Double O's, licensed to kill, and by God, they will be a force to be reckoned with.
All right, Andy tells them, voice hard.
Then let's go to work.
The end.